continue today with the Diamond Sutra. Diamond Sutra is great for a lot of reasons, but one reason why the Diamond Sutra is so great is because the Diamond Sutra is so subversive. It's subversive. Actually, all great religious teachings, all great spiritual teachings are really subversive teachings. Spiritual teaching that makes you feel nice and confirms what you believe, and a spiritual teaching that says, good job, good job, good job, and makes you feel like you are doing a good job is not an effective spiritual teaching. A real good spiritual teaching, the true ones, are really subversive teachings. They're dangerous teachings. They're somewhat frightening teachings. So that's why, you know, someone like the Buddha was attacked. You know, even in the Buddha's life, they tried to kill him several times. And that's why many teachers, such as even Jesus, was attacked and eventually killed. Because truly great teaching is truly subversive teaching. Very important to see that. So Diamond Sutra is not designed to make you feel nice. It's not to make you feel nice and happy and Buddhism is wonderful, everything is wonderful. Actually, the Diamond Sutra is to show you that everything you think about religion, everything you think about yourself, is actually not the way it really is. So the Diamond Sutra is great. It's the greatest of subversive teachings because it says that everything is not what it appears to be. That's the teaching of the Diamond Sutra. It cuts through illusion because it says what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you taste, what you touch, what you think normally is not really truth. Truly seeing, truly hearing, truly smelling, truly tasting in this moment, that's interesting. But what you normally think it to be is not it. So it's a very subversive teaching. And we've been talking about how the Diamond Sutra is really clear about saying that religious ceremony and forms of religion, even Buddhism, that's not true Buddhism. We're going to resume with, I'm going to look again at chapter 11, which is what we touched on before. Chapter 11 is really great because it's about the superiority of uncreated merit. Okay? So, you know, when we grow up, we watch our parents go to the temple and we learn from a very young age that doing good things, doing some charity, doing some boshi, doing some giving, some generosity, some donation, or helping people is very good. That's very good religious life. In Islam, everyone is called upon to give money to the poor and to help the needy. In Christianity as well. Also in Buddhism, a very great value is placed on giving things to people. And this is, even in Buddhism, a very, very, very high value. Among the six paramitas, the upparamil, these six practical things that you can do for a good religious life, among the six things that the Buddha says, the highest one is charity. So it's fundamental in all religions, giving things. Now it doesn't mean the object. To give things means to let go of yourself. It doesn't just mean giving the object. It means letting go of this mind that I keep something. I keep my mind. I keep my position. It means giving and connecting with someone else. Chapter 11 is very subversive in the whole Diamond Sutra because it's saying that, yeah, charity is very good, but the highest charity is not giving things. The highest charity is studying the mind. So we look at chapter 11 again. Sabuti, if there were rivers as the sand grains of the Ganges, would the sand grains of all be many? Sabuti said, many indeed, world-honored one. Even the Ganges rivers would be innumerable. How much more so would be their sand grains? Sabuti, I will declare you, if a good man or a good woman filled 3,000 galaxies of worlds with the seven treasures for each sand grain in all those Ganges rivers and gave all away in gifts of alms, would such a person get great merit? Subhuti answered, great indeed, world-honored one. So if someone made a huge donation, if Bill Gates gave away all of his money, or Egon Hee, Samsung Haejangnim, gave away all of their money, would they make great merit? Yes, Buddha. That's what that first part means. Then the Buddha declared, nevertheless, even though that's great merit to give away all these great things, that is definitely great. Nevertheless, Subhuti, if a good man or good woman studies this discourse only so far as to receive and retain four lines of it, the Diamond Sutra, and teaches and explains them to others, the consequent merit would be far greater. So it doesn't mean this book. It doesn't mean just this book. If you teach this book, you get great merit. If you teach this religion, it says if you are able to liberate people from the conception in their mind that they believe is real, if you can show them that every conception in their mind is fundamentally empty, the good ones, the bad ones, the sad ones, the happy ones, the angry ones, the right ones, the wrong ones, the yesterday ones, the tomorrow ones, if you can show someone that that is fundamentally empty, that is the highest merit. That is the higher merit than giving away all of your money. It's a very simple teaching, but very, very, very revolutionary in religion. Chapter 12 goes on like that. This is where we'll start today. Chapter 12 is real interesting. It's interesting. In religious traditions, I was raised Catholic. Maybe some of you are Christian. Many of you are Buddhists. You know, part of religious practice, and, you know, if you're believing in Islam too, same thing. In Judaism, you know, some of the most incredible fighting happens. Some of the most incredible fighting happens over these places where the holy person stayed. You know, like where Jesus was killed, or where Muhammad went up to heaven. That's Mecca. Or where, that's the Temple Mount, I'm sorry, in Mecca where he gave some of his teachings. And where, for example, Jesus died or suffered, or where the Buddha taught. In most religions, there's fighting because they believe that that holy spot is true. To truly protect that holy spot is protecting the religion, is protecting the teacher, the God, whatever. But this is really interesting. This chapter talks about true veneration. If you truly want to venerate, if you truly want to honor, if you truly want to show respect for some article of the religion, this teaching says it's not in those places. It's not in those sungji, those holy places, the holy things. When I was raised Catholic, we were taught to some piece of the cross, some holy cup, some holy spot. You go there and you bow to it. Even in Buddhism, we have this. Bongjongam, or some, maybe Tongdosa, or some place where there's a holy thing from the Buddha, maybe his sadi, or something like that. And in any religious tradition, we have this mind. That is holy. We must honor that place. We must honor that article. We must honor that thing. That is, and you know, when you go on these Songji Sule, you go on these pilgrimages, oh, soon, in 10 minutes, we arrive at the place where the Buddha gave his first teachings, and you feel your heart beating. And oh, for Christians, maybe this summer, we hear in August, a group, maybe 6,000 Korean Christians will go to Jerusalem. The government is saying, don't go, don't go, don't go. Everyone's killing each other there. Don't go. And there's, we must go. We must see where Jesus put his foot. And they get a lot of faith mind. This is very interesting. This chapter 12 completely hits that, because it says, don't venerate dead Buddhas. Don't venerate dead saints. Don't venerate dead religion. That spot, that object, that sungji, that holy place, that's not more holy. Don't get into that mind. So this whole sutra is about all form. Everything that you think is something is actually not what it is. So, let's read it. Veneration of the true doctrine. Furthermore, Subhuti, you should know that wheresoever this discourse is proclaimed by even so little as four lines, That place should be venerated by the whole realms of gods, men, and titans, or asura, as though it were a Buddhist shrine, a stupa. How much more is this so in the case of one who is able to receive and remember the whole and read and recite it throughout? Sabuti, you should know that such a person attains the highest and most wonderful truth. Wheresoever this sacred discourse may be found, there should you comport yourself as though in the presence of Buddha and disciples worthy of honor. So, very interesting. So, in most religions, there is this practice of venerating, of respecting, of treasuring some place, some object, something, some book, more than anything else. You will even kill people. We see this in religion every day. You will kill people to protect that place, to protect that holy thing, that holy object. People will kill each other. And the Buddha says, that's not real religion. That's worshiping a dead spirituality, that object from 2,000 years ago. Actually, this teaching, the teaching of emptiness, the teaching that true charity has no form, the teaching that true enlightenment is not a thing, that you already have it, that it's not something that the Buddha had and you don't. To get that mind, to really get that mind, wow. When the Buddha got enlightenment, he didn't get anything special. Wow. That is the same as my mind. Wow. That's true religion. So the Buddha says, venerate that mind if you want to venerate something. Venerate that, not the form. Not the article, not an object. Don't worship dead Buddhas. Don't worship dead Buddhas. Very interesting point. So, a very famous quote from Zhangzi, Chuangzi, the great Taoist philosopher Chuangzi, or Zhangzi in Korean. He used to say that studying the words and speech, collecting the words and speech, the knowledge of great teachers and sages, he said, it's like collecting dung. It's like collecting manure. A couple days ago, I had to wait for somebody for an hour and a half for something for one sunim. And so while I was there, there was nothing to do. I was already dressed, ready to go to a Dharma talk. And the TV was there, so I was looking at the TV in this situation. And there was this religious broadcasting channel on from the United States. And the person was walking around with the Bible. Oh, walking around with a book. Quoting and this chapter you must believe this, you must believe, and they show it on the screen and everything. That's not true teaching. The teaching that uses those words to point at your mind, that's true teaching. But the words themselves, collecting those words, collecting, getting professional with those words, that's not the true teaching. Being able to be very good at that, that's not true spirituality. What the words are pointing to, finding that, that's true religion. So the Buddha says here, to merely venerate the form of religion, the objects, the places, the words, the books, that's not true religion. How do you use that to find what your true nature is? It's a very important point. So I want to look at this again, because there's something very interesting that the Buddha is talking about here. Furthermore, Sabuti, you should know that wheresoever this discourse is proclaimed, by even so little as four lines, that place should be venerated by the whole realms of gods, men, and titans. So it's not something that happened, you don't venerate something that happened yesterday, something that happened 2,000 years ago. That's not worthy of respect. But this place, the mind that wakes up, that doesn't consider enlightenment some thing, some special thing, that sees that everyone already has it. That mind should be venerated, should be treated like Bongjongam or Tongdosa or Jerusalem or Mecca. That point, that mind, the mind that wakes up from delusion, that mind itself, that's the holy place. That's the true holy place. And that is not a religious place. It's beyond religion. So this is very subversive, as I said, because he completely knocks down any religious form, this thing that makes walls and separation, and Buddhism and Christianity and Islam and Judaism. That is not true religion. But the mind that wakes up, that's true religion. That's very subversive teaching. So when he says this teaching, whoever, even so little as four lines, anyone who gets the point that even four lines of this teaching or has that experience should be venerated more than a place. Then what's very interesting is he talks about this, that place should be venerated by the whole realm of gods, men, and titans. That's the three fortunate realms, gods, men, and asura. So, it just means that the highest levels of consciousness even the highest levels of consciousness must bow down. Even Buddhas and Bodhisattvas must bow down in front of that mind that realizes its fundamental nature. That's all. So, again, it takes away religion, totally takes away religion, and puts instead in the front, living experience of the Dharma. That is holy. That's holier than a statue, holier than a temple, holier than the Palman de Jangyong. And one more thing that the Buddha does with this chapter, very interesting. Until this point, until the Diamond Sutra time in Hinayana Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism, of the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the Sangha, the Sanim, was because there were no Buddha statues, right? No Buddha statues at that time. Also, there were no sutras for 200, 300 years. Nothing was written down. So there was no sutras. There was no teachings like this written down. But there was only one jewel that was very important. That was the Sangha of, and at that time it was only monks. Only monks. So, of the three jewels, the one that people were taught to really respect was monks and nuns. And that's very important, maybe for some tradition. But this point, this Mahayana Buddhism, this Daesung Bulgyo teaching point is, now, from this point, this teaching, which means Dharma, should be venerated more. Dharma can be attained by monk and nun, also by layperson, not monk and nun, ilban saram. So, a very radical statement that time. That time, only until that time, of the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the only visible one was Sangha. But the Buddha says, that's not the holiest thing. Actually, Dharma, this teaching, wherever this sacred discourse, wherever you hear this teaching, wherever you see or realize this teaching may be found, there you should behave, you should comport yourself as though you were in the presence of the Buddha and disciples were. So, from now on, this Dharma, he's saying, this Dharma is equal to Buddha. So if you get this teaching, that's equal to Buddha. Very radical statement. That time, the teaching was many lifetime, many lifetime, many lifetime, many lifetime, get nirvana. But this says, in one moment, if you get this teaching, you're the same level as Buddha. That wasn't being taught at that time. That's this radical statement of the Diamond Sutra, okay? So, how this teaching should be received and retained. At that time, Subhuti addressed the Buddha, saying, world-honored one, by what name should this discourse be known, to know it? By what name should this discourse be known, and how should we receive and retain it? The Buddha answered, Subhuti, This discourse should be known as the diamond of the perfection of transcendental wisdom. Thus should you receive and retain it. Subhuti, what is the reason herein? According to the Buddha teaching, the perfection of transcendental wisdom is not really that amazing. Perfection of transcendental wisdom is just a name given to it. Subhuti, what do you think? Has the Tathagata a teaching to enunciate? Subhuti replied to the Buddha, World Honored One, the Tathagata, in other words, you, have nothing to teach. Then the Buddha says, Subhuti, what do you think? Would there be many molecules in the composition of 3,000 galaxies of worlds? Subhuti said, many indeed, World Honored One. Subhuti, the Tathagata declares that all these molecules are really such. They are called molecules. Furthermore, the Tathagata declares that a world is not really a world. It is merely called a world. Subhuti, what do you think? May the Tathagata be perceived by the 32 physical peculiarities of an outstanding sage? No, World Honored One. The Tathagata may not be perceived by these 32 marks. Wherefore? Because the Tathagata has explained that the 32 marks are not really such. They are merely called the 32 marks. Subhuti, if on the one hand a good man or a good woman sacrifices as many lives as the sand grains of the Ganges, and on the other hand anyone receives and retains even only 4 lines of this discourse and teaches and explains them to others, the merit of the latter will be greater. Okay, so, very simple. This Subhuti still wants to call it something. He wants to call this teaching something. The teaching of emptiness, what do we call it? How do we know it? What shape is it? What form is it? What religion is it? Is this your teaching, my teaching, Buddha's teaching? What is it? So he wants to understand it by a name. That's all, very simple. But the Buddha has already said that this doesn't have a name. Yeah, he calls it perfection of wisdom, but he says that name is not a name. If you call it Buddhism, it's not Buddhism. It's not Buddhist. It's not my teaching. It's not Tathagata teaching. Just see it. See that your mind is empty. That's the teaching. See that all forms have no meaning. That's the teaching. See that merit is fundamentally empty. That's the teaching. See that the highest charity is to liberate someone from their thinking. That's the teaching. See that. But you don't have to call it anything. You don't need to name it, to label it, to package it in order to do it. That's what the Buddha is saying right here. So, at that time, Subhuti addressed the Buddha. What name should this discourse be known? The Buddha said, this discourse should be known as the diamond of the perfection of transcendental wisdom. So, Panya Paramil. There's Yuk Paramil. There's 6 paramitas. And the 6th one is wisdom. Boshi, Dongjin, Inyok, all Then the 6th one is wisdom. The Buddha says the most important paramita, the most important perfection that a human being can attain is wisdom. Wisdom. Wisdom, wisdom. That's all. Just wisdom. That's the highest teaching of the paramitas, is wisdom. Why? Actually, all the paramitas are the same. They're just different ways to function. It's like different fingers on a hand that washes your face. Each finger does its job. No finger is better than the other. But, he says, wisdom actually has insight. Wisdom controls all of the other 5 paramitas. Wisdom controls the other perfections. Wisdom has the greatest role in religious life. Boshi is wonderful. Donation is wonderful. Effort is wonderful. But without wisdom, charity has no true way. It's just giving. It's like Red Cross or something. Effort, well, people working in an office every day can have that. That's not special. Without wisdom, any effort doesn't really mean anything. So this teaching is about wisdom, and wisdom is the highest of the six paramitas. That's what he is saying here. But this highest of the six paramitas, highest spiritual practice, is not a quote-unquote highest spiritual practice. Also, throw that away. Don't call it anything. Don't know it as anything. Don't package it. Just throw it away. Very simple. Don't even call it Buddhist. Throw it away. Just do it. That's better than calling it anything. So that's our practice. Naming it, understanding it, analyzing it. That's not what this teaching's about. How do you do it? How do you do it? How do you see moment to moment that your thinking is empty? How do you see moment to moment that there is cause and effect? There is cause and effect, but the cause and effect has no nature. How do you do it? And realize that there is enlightenment in Buddhism, but the enlightenment is not a thing. It's not a separate thing. And that all beings already have it. How do you do that? That's what you should call it. Just by doing that. By attaining that. So this is about attaining. This sutra is not about intellectual understanding. So Subhuti keeps wanting to have an intellectual understanding of Buddhism. And the Buddha keeps knocking him down. He won't let him name it. Yeah, the Buddha names it, but says that name doesn't mean anything, okay? So, Jesus did not call his teaching Christianity. Buddha did not call his teaching Buddhism. So we shouldn't do that either. Okay? That's the teaching of this first part. So, he asks in the second paragraph, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata, Buddha, me, do I have some teaching to talk about? Very interesting teaching. The Buddha says to Subhuti, do I have some teaching to proclaim, to declare? Do I have something? And Subhuti says, no, you have nothing to teach. That's amazing. Amazingly subversive. Even his student says, Buddha, you have nothing to teach. And the Buddha says, correct. Correct. In the right before the Buddha died, the Buddha was about to die. His body was about to die. And he was very sick. And Mahakashyapa said to him, oh, teacher, don't die yet. Please don't die. Please continue teaching us eternally. Please keep teaching us for eternal time. Please keep turning the wheel of the Dharma. Don't leave. Please give us more. Give us more. Give us more. The Buddha already saw, even before he died, they're attached to my... I've been teaching them about letting go of attachment, but they're attached to my non-attachment. Please teach us more. He's sick. He's been teaching 45 years in India. It's hot there. Here it's hot in Korea. This is nothing. This is a winter day in India. You guys think you're hot? There's no fans in India. Hot! Buddha's like, okay, I've been doing this 45 years, plus, 35 years, 25 years in the palace, 10 years doing suhang. This is too much. Time for me to go. Yolban, nirvana. And his student says, sir, please stay in this hot environment and teach us eternally. Some of you are the same. You laugh, but you're the same. Whenever I stop giving a Dharma talk for 1 or 2 weeks, why isn't Young Gaksinim teaching? Why not? I can't understand Buddhism. That's attachment mind. Buddhism anymore. It's about an attachment to somebody. So the Buddha saw that and he made this very famous statement.
He made this very famous statement right before he died. When his student said, "Hey, teach us eternally," the Buddha said, "I have been teaching you for 45 years, but I have never said one word to you. I haven't given you anything new. For 45 years, I've been saying many, 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 many things, but I didn't give you one thing that's new. I didn't give you anything that you didn't already have, stupid." That's amazing. Subversive. Very subversive. Incredibly subversive. He's even undercutting his own position. "I've been teaching, but doesn't mean anything." So here, perfection of transcendental wisdom is just the name given it at Subhuti. Then Subhuti says, "Yes, you have nothing to teach." That's just like that teaching where the Buddha said, "I taught 45 years, but I didn't say anything special. I just talked about your mind is fundamentally empty, but those words are not important." Then the Buddha asked, "Subhuti, what do you think? Would there be many molecules in the composition of 3,000 galaxies of worlds?" "Many indeed, world-honored one." "Subhuti, the Tathagata declares that all these molecules are not really such. They are called molecules. Furthermore, the Tathagata declares that a world is not really a world. It is merely called a world." So he's showing from the smallest molecule to 3,000 galaxies of worlds. Amazing. So, from the nearest thing we can see to the farthest thing we can imagine, from the smallest thing you can conceive of to the largest thing that you can't even get your mind around, it's all empty. It's all empty. Your relationship to that is also empty. All perception is fundamentally empty. Perceiving this as small and that as large, a molecule as right here, and a galaxy as very far away. All perception is empty. That's fundamentally true, actually. You know, everyone thinks time is long, but when you go to sleep, 1 hour passes like that. Which one is right, when you're awake or when you're asleep? When you're awake and you have thinking, time is long. Time is long. Yeah, last night I took a plane from Hong Kong. 3 hours. 3.5 hours. It's a long time to be sitting in a chair. Long time. Midnight flight, 12 o'clock midnight until 3:30 in the morning, but time was different. Then I got back here, you know, only 2 or 3 hours of sleep. In the plane, actually 1 hour of sleep. So I got back, and this morning, downstairs in the temple, I had a little rest. Then, same amount of time, but it, like that. I just closed my eyes, open up. So, that perception, the Buddha says, when you're thinking, it seems long. You know, if you have to stand on your leg, if I say, stand on your leg, one leg, for 3.5 hours, that 3.5 hours seems very long, right? But if I say, if you haven't slept in 2 days, and I say, okay, now you can sleep for 3.5 hours, like that. So, from the smallest atom to the biggest galaxy, from the nearest thing to the farthest thing away, it's all fundamentally empty. So last night, the people who took me to the airport in Hong Kong, very close. Then this morning I called them back, "Oh, chal dochakesunida." When I called them, they're very far away. But doesn't feel like that. So it's all based on thinking. So it's just a name. Near is a name. Far is a name. Big is a name. Small is a name. Molecule is a name. World is a name. It's just a name. It's just a name. You think Downtown Seoul is very close. My parents in America think it's very far away. So, dependent origination. Everything arises according to thinking. Everything arises according to thinking. Time, space, near, far. But Quantstein says that her book is near. I say it's, she says yogi. I say chogi. To her mind, her book is yogi. It's next to her, here. But I say chogi. It's far. That's all based on thinking. And that thinking is deep. If you get that, you're liberated. Something is liberated. Next line. Subhuti, what do you think? May the Tathagata be perceived by the 32 physical marks. So, just like we said last week, many people thought that if you're a great person, you have to look like this, 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 look like this. A very holy person. I like it. As an American person, sometimes old monks, very old monks say, wow, nuni parada. Blue eyes. Wow, you have blue eyes. So you are, you know, one of the 32 marks of a Buddha. One of the 32 marks of a Buddha is blue eyes. So some people will come up and go, they're stuck. Because they think this form means something. So even one monk said to me, oh, some Western people, they have blue eyes, so they're closer to the Buddha. Yeah, maybe. Our DNA is closer. We come from the Buddha, but not in any other way. So this part of the sutra is hitting this idea of a certain form that a holy person appears, an enlightened person appears as a certain form. Right? That's why for some of you who are Christian, you understand, in the Bible, people were expecting this new God, Son thing to appear a certain way. Then this Jesus comes and he looks, he's poor, not so good, not so this, not so... So they didn't, oh, no, that's not it. No, it can't be. He's not supposed to look like that. It's supposed to be something like that. So that's where, boom, he hit them. Same thing with Buddhism. The Buddha hits that right here. No, world-honored one, that the Tathagata may not be perceived by these 32 marks. Wherefore? Because the Tathagata has explained that the 32 marks are not really such, they are merely called 32 marks. So, all form is empty. Next, the last paragraph is very interesting, very interesting. In Buddhism at that time, very important value is renunciation. Cut your hair and become a monk or nun. In this last paragraph, it's not so important. Subhuti, if on the one hand a good man or a good woman sacrifices as many lives as the sand grains of the Ganges River, and on the other hand receives and retains even only 4 lines of this discourse, and teaches and explains them to others, the merit of the latter will be greater. So, a good man or a good woman renounces, gives up as many lifetimes as sand grains by the Ganges River. If you become a monk or a nun, that many times, that's great merit. But greater merit? Even greater. At that time, that was the highest in Hinayana Buddhism. Highest thing is become monk. Become nun, but become sannin. But now this is Mahayana time. That was Hinayana time. Now this is Mahayana time. They say, yeah, that's great merit. But if you get wisdom, if you get real wisdom, real insight into the nature of this universe, whether you have hair or don't have hair, that's greater merit. So that's revolutionary speech. Revolutionary speech. Very interesting, very radical speech, very subversive speech. Okay, that's all that means. Before, giving boshi was giving like jewels of things, but now, giving your life to wisdom, whether you have hair or don't have hair, living for wisdom. That is the highest merit. That's all. Okay?